Hello, and thank you for joining us on the Stay Healthy Knoxville podcast, brought to you by Simply Physio, aimed at helping you live an enjoyable, fit, and healthy life in and around our community of Knoxville, Tennessee. And now, here is your host, Dr. John Mark Chesney.
Well, welcome here to the Stay Healthy Knoxville podcast. I'm super excited to bring to today's show Dr. Quinn Dunlap. So he is a highly specialized and trained ENT physician, an otolaryngologist, trained in all aspects of ENT. However, his passion and primary focus is the treatment of head and neck cancer. This ultimately led to his completion of specialized fellowship training in head and neck surgery, oncology, transoral, robotic surgery, thyroid and parathyroid surgery, and microvascular reconstruction. As such, he is the first and only physician to bring this specialized skill to East Tennessee. His education is medical school from the University of Alabama School of Medicine, and his bachelor's from the University of Alabama, which we will not hold against him. also board certified. He has his fellowship at the University of Arkansas for medical sciences in head and neck surgical oncology, transoral robotic surgery, surgery of the thyroid and parathyroid, and microvascular reconstruction. Dr. Dunlap, he enjoys spending time with his wife, Jill, and his son, Anders. Also enjoys a plethora of outdoors activities, including hiking, road biking, running, canoeing, fishing, camping, anything involving a lake. He's a big SEC fan, enjoys virtually all sports, with his favorite being football and baseball. Without question, Dr. Dunlap and his family, they're excited and relatively new to Knoxville area as well. So welcome to Stay Healthy Knoxville to the show, Dr. Dunlap.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And before all the Vols fans cut off the podcast, right. I do pull for the Vols.
Let's get a way to start.
I've followed them through the Super Regionals and into the College World Series. And I've been following all that closely. I don't know if you saw that game last night, but it looks like Florida LSU are going to the College World Series championship.
Yes.
Which is it's kind of my favorite time of the year. I love watching college baseball.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Did you grow up in Alabama?
I did. I grew up in North Alabama, Huntsville area. It's actually a small town called Hartsel, probably about 10,000-15,000 people. Grew up there. And then, elementary school, middle school, high school, all of that. And then went to UAB for undergrad and med school and Arkansas. And, well, you know the rest from there.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, we like to start the podcast. You know you've gone through a lot of schooling and, you know, to get to your specialty and really just understanding, like, kind of taking us back through that journey of how you got even interested in medicine, and then, you know, from medicine into, you know, ENT, and then from ENT into, you know, what you do as far as your work with cancer patients predominantly.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not necessarily one of those people that have like a tremendous story where there was a moment in my life where a switch flipped and like, oh, I want to be a doctor now. I kind of thought that I wanted to be one even in high school. I remember shadowing an orthopedic surgeon in the Huntsville area in high school, and that's what I thought I wanted to do for a while because I played sports in high school, baseball and football, and so I had kind of worked with those guys, but I went to college and kind of fell into this biomedical engineering major, as an 18-year-old, why did I choose that? I mean, it sounded nice. You know, I guess that's the way you make decisions when you're 18. But I remember going on this medical mission trip to Guatemala when I was a sophomore in college, and we went there and, we weren't like doing surgeries or anything like that, but we were helping, you know, passing out dental supplies, showing people how to floss their teeth, how to brush their teeth. There were some dentists with us that were providing actual care, you know, extractions and stuff like that. And I just remember going to these villages and watching these people line up to see us. And they were coming from all over, and how happy they were to see us and how grateful and appreciative they were that we were there. And it was an affirmation of sorts for me that, like, yeah, this is what I want to spend my life doing. I want to help people. This is what I really enjoy doing. And so kind of continued on that path and was fortunate to get into medical school at UAB. And I had always kind of held a job from the time that I was like 15 or 16. My dad used to always be like, yeah, you know, if you don't do well in school, you can always do this for the rest of your life, which I was like outside doing hard manual labor. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try to do well in school then. And so anyways, it was the summer after my first year of medical school. And that's kind of like, for people that aren't in medicine, that's kind of like your last summer. the last summer that you're not like working or doing something. And so I had to find a way to make money to cover my rent and, you know, pay the bills and stuff. And it, the way that I saw it, there were two options. I could either go back to valeting cars, which is what I did in college, working outside, or I could potentially find a job in a research lab and bolster my resume and make some money and be in the air conditioning. And so I started looking for grant money, and I ended up filing for this NIH T35 grant. And there were only two surgeons, and I had this feeling. I had pretty much decided I wanted to do surgery at that point. And so I applied, and what I now appreciate to be truly miraculous after I got to know this individual, this guy named Brad Woodworth, got back to me like in a matter of days, which he never did after that because he's like a very busy guy. And so I sit down in his lab and I come meet with him, and I'm like, yeah, I'm interested in cystic fibrosis research, blah, blah, blah. Cause I had PubMed searched him, and I really just want to get in the lab. And he was like, so I know that you really just want to do ENT, and this is what you need to do. And I was like, yeah, sure. And like, I didn't really even know ENT was like a specialty at that point, but I got in his lab and I started doing the research, and I started following this guy around, and he was doing these endoscopic skull-based procedures. And he was just like a really cool guy, a really fun guy to be around. And then I met the other faculty, and I was like, you know, I think these are my people. Like, I think this is where I get in. And so I started doing all the things necessary to get into ENT, and was very fortunate, and he helped me a lot. And so I got some research publications. And
so he was an ENT?
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's the current chair at UAB of the department. He wasn't at the time, but yeah, he has his own research lab there. He's a very, very good endoscopic skull-based surgeon. So he mentored me through that. And I ended up getting into residency at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, which is, I'm biased, but a really good ENT program. And so came around to about my fourth year, and I was looking at applying to the American Head and Neck Society fellowship match because I had decided that I wanted to do head and neck surgery. And so when you're ENT residency, you kind of get training in all these different areas, and you could probably divide it into seven different areas if you wanted. There's pediatrics and sleep medicine and laryngology and otology, neurootology, which is ear surgery, and facial plastics and rhinology and head and neck surgery. I don't know if I've been through all seven, but that's
sounded close.
Yeah. So you kind of rotate. And when you're in residency, you're at this academic medical center, and there are physicians there that are kind of specialty trained in all these areas. And so you kind of get your taste of what you want to do. And at the residency program that I went to, it was about 50-50. 50% of people would kind of go out into private practice and do general ENT, which is great. And about 50% of people would pursue fellowships afterwards. So I had kind of made up my mind that I was going to do head and neck surgery fellowship. And in the meantime, I had met my wife, Jill, and we were pretty serious. And we were engaged and talking about getting married. And once my head and neck mentors, like I went to them for rec letters and stuff, and I'm trying to get my application together, they were kind of like, hey, how about you just stay here? And how about you just stay here for your fellowship? And I was like, okay, let me think about it. And so I went and I made some phone calls and I thought about it, and it just made a lot of sense. I have a lot of respect for those guys and their skill set and the way that they do things. And so I stuck around for an additional year to do my
UAB?
UAMS, University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences.
Okay.
That's in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so Arkansas is kind of a bit of a hidden gem. I remember it after our match, my dad was like, you're going to Arkansas? I was like, yeah, that's where I'm going. But if you like outdoor stuff, it's a great place to be. They have really great state parks, really great outdoor opportunities. The geography is a little bit different from here, but kind of the same in that there's a lot to do outdoors. Yeah, and so I did the head and neck fellowship. And, during the intro, I know there's a lot of big words in there, but what it's really encompassed in is dealing with benign and malignant tumors of the head and neck, and essentially removing those tumors and, if needed, providing the reconstruction necessary to kind of patch everything up to get things as close back to normal as you can. And that can be relatively straightforward. It can be as simple as closing an incision, or it can be relatively complex, such as harvesting a free flap.
If you don't mind me asking, I'd imagine very technical like with some of that is even like looking back from where you are now, like, cause you didn't necessarily have like this vision, like when you were in high school or even college or even in med school, right? That this is like what I want to do, but just kind of interested in how that kind of matches up with like just your personality. Is that kind of always been the kind of part of your personality of very kind of technical, if you will, and highly specialized?
I guess so. That may be more so a question for my wife. I'm sure if she were here, she would gladly take that one. But I think that it's me wanting to gravitate towards doing something and feeling like I'm good at doing that, and feeling like if these people are trusting me, and if they're coming to me for care, then I want to feel like I'm doing the absolute best job that I can for them. And I think when you're a specialist, then that field becomes a little bit smaller. And so, yeah, you can become a little bit more hyper-focused on some of the more, you know, minute details and try to really cross all the T's and dot all the I's. But I think what really made me gravitate towards head and neck cancer surgery is the impact that it has. And so I think that, you know, in the field of ENT, there are a lot of important surgeries, and there are a lot of great surgeries. And, you know, endoscopic sinus surgery is a big one, and it really improves quality of life for people. You know, ear tubes and tonsils, you know, have brought many nights full of sleep to parents around the country. You know, and it helped those kids too. You know, and those kids' ability to hear and, you know, develop, you know, language capabilities and all of those things. And as far as I know, there isn't another field in ENT where you're routinely saving someone's life.
Does head cancer, what you do, does that involve brain cancer?
It doesn't. So the saying that you'll hear is pleura to dura, and so that means from the pleura of the lung to the dura of the brain. And so pretty much everything in between that. And so don't deal with brain tumors, don't deal with spinal cord tumors, don't deal with lung cancer. Now, if there are tumors that cross that barrier, like I have a neurosurgeon here in town that I work with. And so, you know, I'll have people show up and they'll have really bad skin cancers on their head that have eroded through the bone of the skull and are encroaching on the brain, right? And so I'll get a neurosurgeon involved and I'll take off the soft tissue. He'll come in, he'll remove the bone, and then I'll do a free flap to patch the whole area. And so, but I myself, no, I do not cross that barrier. Once we start getting to the dura of the brain, that's when I say, hey, we've got to get another specialist involved here. And so part of doing head and neck cancer is really multidisciplinary care. And so you end up working with a lot of different specialists. And so the neurosurgeon is one. I work with the plastic surgery department at UT Medical Center, and two guys there specifically, Buchwald and Smith, I work with pretty seamlessly and frequently. And then you work with speech path and physical therapy and dietitian and metabolic support and nursing and the case managers and home health. And because a lot of these people require a lot of care. Some of them require tracheostomies. Some of them require feeding tubes. Some of them require both. A lot of them have skin grafts that require ongoing wound care. And so as far as the amount of care that's needed to require for these people, it is a lot. I mean, head and neck cancer can be absolutely devastating.
I have a question about that. And I was talking with another staff member about our podcast and, you know, just kind of giving them the synopsis of what you do. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, head and neck cancer, and, you know, kind of first response is like, oh, wow, that must be tough. Like kind of just dealing with a cancer population, right? And just knowing what that entails, and whether it be, you know, morbidity rates or, you know, I don't know how with the type of cases, you know, you see compared to other types of cancer, like that is as much of a circumstance or something to have to work through. But kind of wondering how you work with that kind of in that field, right? Where, you know, somebody else could see that as like, oh man, that would be tough to work with cancer patients.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that a cancer diagnosis, irrespective of the type of cancer, is a huge emotional burden, you know, for that person, for that person's family, for the day in and the day out. That's tough, right? As far as head and neck cancer goes, it depends on the type of cancer, right? So if you're talking about thyroid cancer, especially differentiated thyroid cancer, it's very treatable. Especially if you catch it early, you know, you're looking at 10-year survival rates that are upwards of 95%. And so a lot of people like to treat those, right? Because it's a one and done, you know, non-smokers, non-drinkers, compliant individuals. And, you know, a lot of times you can come in and do a hemithyroid and send them home the same day.
Sure. And that's why I kind of ask you about even brain cancer. I'm no cancer expert, but I know a brain cancer, you know, diagnosis is not one that you want to be dealing with just right. with the mortality rates associated with it.
And so I would put, you know, and then you have like head and neck squamous cell carcinoma, which is, I would say, probably upwards of 90% of the head and neck cancers that you see. If you exclude thyroid and you're looking at other head and neck cancers, and that one can be highly aggressive and it can be very devastating. And it depends on whether it starts on the skin. If it's on the skin, it's not as bad. If it's on the mucosal surface, so you talk about oral cavity cancers, tongue cancers, laryngeal cancer. Yeah, that's really tough stuff, and it's really tough stuff to treat. And you know, you're likely talking about at the least surgery. Or at the least chemo radiation, or possibly surgery with radiation. And it's this, it's the type of thing that, you know, is going to affect that individual for the rest of their life. The surgery that you do, the treatment that is necessary to cure it. And so kind of to your point, I think that if you find yourself in that position, if it were me, I would want to go to someone that sees this day in and day out. That knows what is necessary and that is comfortable with doing what is necessary to treat it and treat it the right way the first time around.
And just kind of perspective too with your job, usually when people come to you, have they already been diagnosed, or is that as part of your process of actually diagnosing somebody with this type of cancer?
So it's changed a little since I got here. When I first got here, I was doing a lot of the diagnosing. I was getting a lot of referrals from primary care physicians, and that's great. If you're a primary care physician, you're listening, please keep sending people to me. Thank you for referring patients to me. And if I need to work them up, I'm happy to work them up. I'm very familiar with how that goes and what is necessary. But there's been kind of a shift now because I'm coming up on being here about 2 years where kind of the other physicians and subspecialties in the community, it seems that they have realized that like, oh yeah, there's this guy over here that will do these things. And so if that referral comes from another ENT or from an endocrinologist or from a Mohs surgeon, then they're pretty well worked up because those guys, they know exactly what, you know, what needs to be done. They just need to get them to the person that, you know, is willing to do it. And so a lot of people already have that cancer diagnosis, and much of my discussion revolves around like, okay, we know you have this diagnosis and now this is what is going to be necessary to treat it and really hear your options, you know, and none of them, you know, I'll just tell them this head and neck cancer. There are no easy roads. If there was, I would lead with it. But these are the options that we have here. There are some options, but I'll go through that with them in detail, and try to explain it as plainly and clearly as I can. And then we kind of press forward.
Yeah. And this is, I know we're going to get into kind of more of kind of technical kind of understanding of, you know, techniques and options on the second half of the podcast, but kind of just interested in as a medically trained individual, you know, medical school. And again, kind of, you know, working with people in this population, like is part of your training or even school just interested in like kind of dealing with the emotional side of like a cancer, like is that something you've had to learn, or when there's been cases of having to talk people through of maybe like, hey, listen, I got some bad news, right? Just kind of interested in how you've developed, you know, that skill. If it's, again, if there's kind of a course kind of talked about, or if it's more on the job training of, you know, working with other people in the field that have kind of guided you. Cause again, I'd imagine that would be a very kind of tough position to be in, right? If you're, you know, especially whether it be breaking the news or, you know, having to relay even more in-depth, you know, information about a certain diagnosis.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a really insightful question. And so there is not a course that you take. There's not like a course in residency, or maybe there's one in medical school, not one that I recall, but it's definitely something that you learn. Right. And if you are a human being that cares about other human beings, and when you go through residency, you know, all otolaryngologists that go through residency get training in head and neck surgery. So you see these people and you're at an academic medical center. And so you see people with big cancers, bad disease, you know, big surgeries, and you take care of them day in and day out, and you see their families and you see their outcomes. The way that shifts a little bit once you get out of residency is, when you're in a residency, it's like you're on a rotation for a month, 2 months, 3 months. You see that person, you do that surgery, you follow them immediately, and then you kind of move on to your next rotation. Whereas once you get out of training, you follow that person for a long time, right? And any complications that they have, you see. And any complications that they have, you deal with.
So you're saying most of your clients that you follow Is that what you're saying? You have on for your caseload, if you will, for a long time.
Oh yeah. I follow them and I have a spreadsheet where I keep track of the cases that I've done and the complications. And I make sure that, you know, what I'm doing is on par with what's acceptable nationally and all of those things. But on the emotional side, I think a lot of it is, you know, A, letting that person know that you care, letting them know that you know, you care about this and that you want to help them and that you are willing to bend over backwards for them. And then the second part of it is expectation management. And like, I understand that you have this. I understand that, you know, you want this treated. I understand that you want it to be as painless as possible. But, you know, here's the kicker. This is what is needed. This is what is needed to treat this. And this is what you can expect from this. And I have had people come back around on the back end and they were like, yeah, you know, that was hard. But it was easier because I knew what to expect. And so I think that's, you know, not to get too philosophical, but I think that's true in life. When your expectations align, it's easier to tolerate something. But, you know, people tend to get upset when things that are unexpected occur.
Sure. Yeah. And I think there's, you know, we see some, I mean, cases in our clinic and physical therapy of kind of more of like a chronic pain or something where the pain isn't easily explained, you know, sometimes. And I think that can be like a hard place to be is when you don't really have an understanding or expectation. And sometimes like when you can explain in a way that helps people make sense of it, like something complicated, even though it doesn't necessarily change like what's going on, but how, you know, just we're working with the human body, right? And the human body is more than bones and ligaments and tissue, you know, it's also, you know, being and a spirit and just how that all, you know, interrelates, you know, is a fascinating thing, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that, you know, the point that you're bringing up there, I think that's maybe the hardest part of my job. It is the emotional burden that is there and carrying that. And I also have noticed kind of to your point that where that person is mentally definitely affects their outcome. Mm-hmm. It definitely does. If you would have asked me that, you know, in residency, I would have said, that's hocus pocus, right? You know, like you give them a good surgery, they get the right treatment. That's what determines it. And you need that, yeah. Right? You need that. But I've seen people that are so determined that, and it really makes a difference versus someone that, has kind of lost hope. Sure. That is kind of hopeless. And so some of those visits, you know, I see people in the middle of their radiation treatment, even if I didn't operate on them. And, you know, the main purpose of that visit is encouragement, is to say, hey, I know this is tough. Like, keep going, keep going. I know people that have went through what you went through and you can make it, you know, sort of thing. And so I think the mental component is a really, really big aspect of it. And it's draining. You know, you don't feel good after you see that person or after you have to have that hard conversation. But then you will see that person on the other side. And they are usually very, very grateful, and very appreciative and very happy, and their family is happy. And they almost have a new appreciation for life. You know, it's kind of like that Live Like You Are Dying song. Bit, you know, like once you have been through something that bad, you start to really get a lot of enjoyment out of the most basic things that maybe you took for granted before.
Well, awesome. Well, that's, yeah, fascinating to hear too, even from your perspective of seeing that play out as far as, you know, somebody's, you know, mindset. And, you know, I know you're not saying that it's all in your head and you can just, you know, believe that you're going to get better, right?
No, I have people that believe that. And I try to really counsel against that. But I do think that it has something to do.
Sure. Yeah. That it does make an impact and, you know, in their ability to handle what it takes, you know, potentially to, you know, cause like you said, you know, treatment can be difficult, right? Recovery can be difficult, you know, with that. So yeah, I want to take a break here and we'll hear a word from our sponsor and then we're going to come back and we're going to be talking more about as far as head and neck cancer and specifically what, you know, what would make you more at risk of cancer. Things that you can do to help prevent it if you've been recently diagnosed and talking about the options, the different options that you may have. Stay with us to hear Dr. Quinn Dunlap talk more about head and neck cancer.
Stay Healthy Knoxville is sponsored by Simply Physio. a physio clinic that equips and empowers you to live your life to the fullest so that you can enjoy the things you love to do and be the person you are made to be. Simply Physio specializes in helping people get back to a healthy and active lifestyle, living free from pain and medication, and avoiding unnecessary surgery. Stay tuned until the end of the episode to receive a special gift from Simply Physio, and enjoy listening to the rest of the episode.
All right, welcome back to the show, guys. So, Dr. Dunlap, we've been talking about head and neck cancer, and so we'd love to hear from you as far as whether it be, you know, risk factors or preventative kind of medicine when, you know, talking about this type of cancer.
With risk factors for head and neck cancer, you know, the big two are smoking and drinking, and I would probably put it in that order. And when I say smoking, I predominantly mean tobacco use. And you know, what I would also put in that category, maybe as a subcategory, is smokeless tobacco is included. And so those products are known to be carcinogenic. And you know, it's not the sort of thing where, you know, you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day for a month, you're going to get head and neck cancer. But oftentimes this is ongoing for, you know, someone that has smoked a pack or two packs a day for 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Where does vaping fall into that?
So we don't really know. You know, as a physician, I would say you shouldn't do that either. But it hasn't really been around long enough for us to appreciate, you know, whether there are any health detriments available. And so I definitely have a number of patients. You say, are you still smoking? They say, no, I'm vaping. And you say, okay, all right. And so we'll just have to see, because, you know, kind of to the point of it, you know, sometimes this takes 20, 30, 40 years. We don't really, you know, not that much time has passed since vaping has came around. My concern is that maybe it could be worse because it's even less natural and more synthetic than, you know, than even cigarettes. Now that may be a hard bill to sell. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff in cigarettes, but we don't really know if and how this will manifest. But, you know, I would take the better safe than sorry route when asked that question and say, yeah, you should probably just put it down completely. You don't need it to live your life. And so if you can, you know, we should probably go without it. And then on, you know, as far as the relative contribution of tobacco and alcohol to head and neck cancer, that's a very difficult thing to parse out because it's almost eternally confounding in that, you know, a lot of people that smoke drink, and a lot of people that drink smoke, and some people only smoke when they drink, right? Or at least that's what they tell me. So we don't really know the relative contributions, but it seems to me anecdotally that a lot of the cancer that I see is a lot of times in people that have pretty heavy smoking histories. There is an exception to that, and that is HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer.
How is that different when you're talking about risk factors or preventative with that type of cancer?
You know, for the longest time, all these mucosal head and neck cancers, or cancers that occur along the mucosal surfaces, so in the mouth and in the throat and in the voice box, were associated with smoking and drinking. But then back in the 1990s, people started popping up with these cancers that are kind of on the back of the tongue or in the tonsil that are in non-smokers, non-drinkers. And people can really figure out what was going on. They started studying these, and they basically noted that they're virally induced, and they come from the HPV virus.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. This virus.
Yeah, the human papilloma virus. And so it's pretty ubiquitous in the human population. You know, technically it is a sexually transmitted disease, but it's one of those that pretty much everybody has. I remember I was in med school, and this guy came in, and he was a virologist, and he looked like Einstein's pudgy cousin. And he came in, and his opening line was, look to your left, look to your right, chances are that person has HPV. And of course, the whole classroom like erupted, right? But it's pretty ubiquitous in the human population. There is an ongoing epidemic of people popping up with HPV-induced oropharyngeal squamous cell carcinoma, so much so that it's actually now more common than cervical cancer that is caused by HPV.
And you said it's predominantly the back of the tongue and the back of the throat?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Predominantly the back of the tongue. So the base of the tongue is what we call that, or the tonsil, or the area in between there. And there's lymphoid tissue. That's all lymphoid tissue that the virus is kind of hiding out in. And we don't really know why it manifests in the individuals that it manifests in, but there appears to be a particular preponderance for Caucasian males or white males between the ages of 40 and 60. And so, you know, you get back to prevention and what can we do for prevention? And I would say maybe this is the most important thing I could say on this podcast is, you know, get your kids the Gardasil vaccine. The Gardasil vaccine was initially developed for cervical cancer. Okay. It's called Gardasil 9 because it treats 9 different types of HPV. So there's different subtypes. And there's like 6, 11, 16, 18, 31, 33, 45, 52. I think that's all the ones I can remember. But Gardasil covers 9 of them. And the important ones for HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer are 16, 18, 31, 33. Those are the most important ones. And they initially were only vaccinating females for cervical cancer because there was a cervical cancer epidemic. Well, cervical cancer has almost been snuffed out due to, as far as I know, now I'm not an OB-GYN, so a little outside of my scope there, but as far as I know, it's largely been prevented by this vaccine. We don't have the data to definitively say that is the case for this, but it is FDA approved for this now for oropharyngeal cancer, HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer. And so the vaccine is, it's recommended that it's given at the ages of 11 or 12. And so, you can give it as early as 9. And if it's given between the ages of 9 and 14, it's a 2-shot series. You get the first shot and then you get the second shot somewhere between 6 and 12 months. If you're older than that, so if it's 15 to 45, then it's a 3-shot series. You get the first shot, then second shot at 1 to 2 months, third shot at about 6 months. And so I'm vaccinated. I've had patients ask me that, well, have you done it? And I have. And I really think that a lot of us should be doing it because I really think it holds a lot of promise for prevention of this type of cancer. And the one thing to know about HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer is that it actually has significantly better outcomes than its counterpart HPV negative. Okay. So the smoking and drinking hard-earned cancer, if you will, so much so that before they really figured out all of this out, they noted that there was a discrepancy in the staging. So they, you know, there's stage 1 through 4 cancers, and those are based on survival curves. And they noticed that there were a lot of stage 3, stage 4 people, especially stage 4 people that were having better survival outcomes than the stage 3 people. They're saying, oh, we have a problem with our staging system. Well, they started looking at it and parsing it out, and they figured out that the outcomes of HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer is significantly better than the counterpart, so much so that it was actually skewing the curve. And so they actually had to come up with a separate staging system for HPV positive. And so it really doesn't even go to stage 4 for HPV positive. So it's very treatable, but you still have to have, you may have to have transoral robotic surgery. You may have to have radiation. You may have to have chemo radiation. So it's not something that just goes away on its own. It's real deal head and neck cancer and has to be treated as such, but it is very treatable. And so I did, when we were on the podcast, want to make sure if you're listening and you have a kid, the HPV vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine seems to be safe. I've been vaccinated. My kid will be getting it. I would strongly recommend it.
I was wondering, even on that note, is this something, this is a vaccine that a typical pediatrician would be talking mm-hmm. about? Like, is it kind of standard, like, if you will, like, hey, your kid's 9, you know, we recommend now we get this vaccine? Or is it something like you would think that more needs to be brought up and asked for?
Yeah, so it's not mandatory. And so, and you know, a lot of those vaccines that are lumped in there are really in the early years, right? When you start talking about, you know, the measles vaccine and stuff like that, that's really
polio.
Yeah. That's really early on, right? And it's not a mandatory thing. And I really don't think that there is enough awareness about this. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to mention it here. And I think that a lot of us, there's kind of an initiative in the American Head and Neck Society to kind of try to get this information out there that, hey, this is important. You know, this could really save you a lot of trouble, you know, 40, 50 years down the road. You know, if we do that well, then those people will never know what they were saved from, which is kind of the mantra of head and neck surgery, right? You do your job really well, that person will never know how bad things could have gotten. But yeah, I think that there is more awareness that needs to be brought to the topic to answer your question. And I think that, you know, I hope that we can get, you know, word out to pediatricians and primary care physicians to maybe push this a little bit harder instead of saying, hey, this vaccine's available. Do you want it or not? And maybe shift that over to, hey, you should really think about
this.
You should really think about doing this. I just don't think that this sort of thing is such a niche thing that it, you know, and there's so many other things that pediatricians and primary care physicians have to worry about and learn that I do think that it's very, it very easily gets over.
Sure. And you said as an adult too, like it's not that you can only receive it when you're a child. But as an adult,
it's approved up until the ages of 45 by the FDA at this point. Now, above the ages of 45, I don't exactly know how that goes. And you know, there are questions about like, well, what if I've already had it? Will this prevent it from coming back? We don't have the answer to any of those questions, but kind of what I would fall back on for any questions of that sort or that this vaccine has not been proven to cause any harm. And so it can only do you good. And so if you can get it, then I would recommend getting it. Even if you're over the age of 45, if you can find a way for your insurance company to pay for it, I would recommend getting it.
Sure. Now, if you mentioned that, you know, that most adults already have this virus. So would it be indicated if you already have virus too?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And I mean, the ideal scenario is that you get it before you've ever had it, right? But if all of us have it, you know, then keeping it at bay is as simple as, well, maybe it's not simple, but generating an immune response, right? And what does a vaccine do? It essentially alerts your immune system to, hey, this is here. This is foreign. This is not something we want to allow to proliferate unchecked. And so I think if you can get it before you've ever been exposed, great. But what's the next best thing if you have been exposed is go ahead and get it and kind of alert your immune system to it.
Sure. And it's, you said it's, you know, it's a series. It's not one that requires like a ongoing booster. It's not anything like that.
No, it's kind of a two and done between 9 and 14 or a three and done between 15 and 45.
Okay, great. And one more question too about kind of going back just one step about just head and neck, you know, cancer. You mentioned tobacco being really the number one, alcohol. Is there like just with alcohol, is there really much of a risk factor if it's not paired with tobacco?
It's a hard thing to quantify because you have to get people to come in and admit that they regularly drink for one. And so there's a reporter bias there. And then you have to be able to follow them over time. And so there is definitely an association of alcohol with the causation of head and neck cancer outside of smoking. Is definitely there. The relative contribution or the impact of that is very hard to definitively determine, you know, especially down to the level of, hey, if you drink this many beers per day, or if you drink this much liquor per day, you will have head and neck cancer. And really even with smoking, I mean, you know, there are people that have 150 pack years and never develop cancer, die of natural causes. You just don't know who's going to develop it and who's not going to develop it. But we do know that you are certainly putting yourself at increased risk if you are, you know, regularly smoking, especially, but also if you're, you know, regularly drinking heavily.
What would be the symptoms of head and neck cancer like that somebody would maybe should be concerned about or have somebody have a medical, you know, professional check assess them?
Right. It's going to be somewhat inherent to where it's located. Lack of healing. So if there's an area that just doesn't seem to heal or get better, especially if it's getting worse.
Like an external wound? Or what do you mean?
It could be on the skin. It could be, you know, say, you know, I've had people come in and say, oh yeah, a bug bit me there, you know, a couple of years ago, just never healed. Well, head and neck cancer doesn't come from bug bites. If you have an area on your skin that isn't healing or an ulcer that isn't healing and it's getting worse or it's abnormal in color and it's getting bigger, that's something. Have a medical professional look at that, a dermatologist or an ENT. If it's in your mouth and there's a sore, right, and that sore is not getting better and it's getting bigger and it's causing pain and it's bleeding, have someone take a look at that. And you know, no thing is too small. I see people all the time that come in and they say, hey, you know, I had a brother or a sister or a cousin that had head and neck cancer and I remember what that was like for them. Can you take a look at this? And yeah, I'm always happy to take a look at it because everything starts small. Every cancer started small. And so the earlier you can catch it, the better.
So it's primarily an external versus internal symptoms. Like, you know, you kind of think of an internal organ, you know, type of cancer. Like it's not going to present itself where you can see it necessarily, right?
Right. Yeah. Probably one of the most ubiquitous things that will happen eventually is weight loss. And so I don't know if you would classify that as an internal symptom, but there's something. If you're eating a normal diet and you have unintentional weight loss, then you should probably see a medical professional and have that worked up. For the HPV oropharyngeal cancer patients, those primary tumors are often very small on the back of the tongue or in the tonsil. And so they usually don't really have symptoms. What they show up with is a neck mass, which is an involved lymph node. So the cancer has went from the back of the tongue or the tonsil to the lymph node in the neck, and they show up with a lymph node kind of right at the top of their neck under the angle of the jaw, and that's their first sign. And so if it's that route, then it's that route. But there can be trouble swallowing, there can be pain with swallowing, there can be ear pain, which not all ear pain is head and neck cancer. So I don't want to pull the fire alarm here.
Voice changes.
Hoarseness that's not getting better, absolutely. Something called hemoptysis. So if you're coughing up blood, that's also something you definitely want to have someone look at. All of those things, and so I think that's a lot of it. If you have recurrent nosebleeds, that can be a sign of really more rare cancers, but that's not something that happens very commonly. And then if you have like any neck mass, any lump or bump you can feel in your neck that doesn't go away, say after 4 to 6 weeks, and especially if it's getting bigger, have someone come and look at it so that you can get it kind of sorted out. And you know, worst case scenario is you have to spend a couple of dollars, but you'll leave with peace of mind. And if it is something, you'll be very glad that you had someone look at it early as opposed to later.
Perfect. Well, why don't we get into now treatments? Because I know that's, you know, ultimately what you specialize in. And it sounds like there may be kind of different options, but would love to hear, especially what you know your specialty and how you help people, you know, with treatment.
And so, when you talk about head and neck cancer, kind of the big three treatment arms that you look at are surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. Okay, surgery can stand alone, radiation can stand alone, chemotherapy virtually never stands alone. There is a fourth arm that has kind of entered, called immunotherapy. And so there are some new, pretty groundbreaking drugs. That is you could do a whole separate podcast on immunotherapy alone, but you'd probably want a medical oncologist for that. That being said, I kind of administer the surgery arm and I follow people long-term. And so I am their head and neck cancer surgeon. And so I will evaluate them. I will perform the surgery that needs to be performed to treat the cancer. I will make a determination as to whether they need adjuvant radiation or not, whether they need adjuvant chemo radiation or not, or whether surgery is not in their best interest and chemo radiation is in their best interest, or radiation alone. Radiation oncologists give radiation therapy. And so for smaller tumors in areas that are difficult to treat with surgery, sometimes you can give radiation alone. The best example I can think of that would be a very early laryngeal cancer. So like a cancer that is on the vocal cords, where, you know, surgery would require removing that vocal cord, which could significantly impact the voice long-term. You give that person radiation. And then, you know, if you have bigger tumors that are in difficult to access places. So like if you have a tumor that's on the back of the tongue, that's a difficult area to get to surgically. And, you know, if you wanted to get back there to do that, you'd have to do a pretty invasive surgery. And so instead that person will get chemo radiation. The exception to that is a procedure that I perform called transoral robotic surgery that uses the Da Vinci robot that allows you to access those tumors, provided that they're small enough, through the mouth and treat that with surgery. So if you can do that, you know, the kind of the crux of that is, well, why would you do that if you could just do chemo radiation? Well, because for selected patients, I believe that ultimately the cure rates are equivalent. That's been proven in the literature. And this, I personally believe the swallowing outcomes are superior. And so when you start talking about treating head and neck cancer, you know, goal number one is to treat the cancer. But goal number two is to preserve the quality of life as much as possible.
Well, could I ask you a question about transoral robotic surgery?
Sure.
And maybe I'm sure you could talk in extensive detail about it, but just kind of generally speaking, you know, when people start hearing robots, robotic surgery, I imagine it could bring up some questions of like, what is actually going on robotic
that's
surgery?
That's right? A great question.
We have this robot, this AI, you know, type of thing with technology and, you know, it's this brainless kind of thing that's happening, or like, are you still kind of doing something, right?
Yes. So, and that's a great question. So for most of those surgeries that I do are actually for HPV positive oropharyngeal cancer, because those primaries, those when I say primary lesion, I mean where the cancer started. Those primary tumors are often quite small. And so if you can get back there and get all the way around the tumor with a healthy cuff of tissue around it, then you can potentially save those. You can almost always save them chemotherapy, but you can potentially save them radiation or decrease that radiation as well. And so what happens during those surgeries? Well, for all of them, the first thing that I do is I clean out the lymph nodes in the neck, and that is called a neck dissection. And that is a standard of care. And if you're going to avoid radiation, you have to do that. And so that's the first part that I do. And that is not done with the robot. That is just me doing that, you know, with my hands and all the instruments available that are usually available. So after that is done, I use a special retractor called a fake Aston Bomb retractor. And I put it in the mouth and I use it to expose the area. And then I bring the robot in and I dock the robot. And it's got four arms, but I only use three of them. One of them has a very high resolution camera. That goes into the mouth and provides a really good visualization. And then the other two are these little arms that have instruments on them that allow me to go in front of the camera and kind of work. And so I'm sitting at a console that's kind of against the wall. And I, you know, I have like eyepieces that I look through, and it gives me a three-dimensional view of the surgical field. And so I'm sitting at this console, and they have, you know, the micro manipulators for the instruments. And I'm looking through here at this three-dimensional field with this high resolution camera, and I'm working around the tumor and removing it. And so that's kind of how it works.
So it's more replacing, instead of your hands in their mouth, like you're using an instrument that's designed to get into those hard to reach places, which your hands literally couldn't fit in.
Right.
Right. To excise the tumor.
Yeah. It's kind of magic school bus esque, right? Yeah. So like if you could shrink my hands down so that I could use them back there. Yeah. And there's very, very good dexterity capabilities with that robot. And they're actually continuing to advance that technology. And I'm not the only one that uses a robot. Robotic surgery is kind of happening across all of medicine and actually at an increased frequency in other fields like urology and general surgery. But they are advancing it, and they just came out with a new single port that is going to probably expand the indications for head and neck, the type of head and neck surgery you can do with the robot. So it's really, really cool and impressive technology.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I know you were kind of going on to, I think the next thing, I forgot what it was, but I kind of stopped you to ask you about the surgery.
So going down the surgery route, and, you know, why is it that I came here to Knoxville, and what is it that I'm doing here? And so for the bigger cancers, the more aggressive ones that require bigger surgeries, you know, a lot of ENTs are trained to do those surgeries. You know, when you talk about removing a voice box, which is called a laryngectomy, or removing half of the tongue, which is called a hemiglossectomy. And you know, these all sound like terrible things. And like nobody electively undergoes these surgeries, right? You're having this done because you've got a life-threatening disease. When you remove that amount of tissue, it creates a large hole, creates a big defect, right? And you really can't just leave that person that way. And so what can you do to restore form and function? Well, in the early 90s, people started pioneering what we call microvascular free tissue transfer, okay? Or if you hear like a head and neck guy's talking chop, they'll say, oh, you need a flap. Oh, you need a free flap. And so what that means is you're taking, you know, a piece of tissue from a different area of the body and you're using it to reconstruct a defect. And that can be soft tissue only, or that can involve soft tissue and bone, or soft tissue and bone and muscle. And so I'll give you a couple of examples. So there was a gym teacher that came into me, and, you know, he was really not a smoker, not a drinker, but he had developed a tongue cancer, and it was pretty bad. And so I had to remove half of his tongue. So I removed half his tongue. I cleaned out the lymph nodes in the neck. And then I went down to his forearm and I harvested a piece of skin and fascia on his forearm, traced the artery and the vein up to kind of the crux of the elbow there. And I harvested that flap. I brought it up and I rebuilt that half of his tongue with that piece of tissue. And then I dropped those vessels down into the neck. I bring a microscope into the field. I suture the arteries together. I suture the vein together so that piece of tissue has its own blood supply, and then it heals in. And he's got a new half tongue over there, right?
That came
from his forearm, right? And so just yesterday, there was a young girl who came in and she had ameliblastoma, which is a benign tumor, but very invasive. And it was destroying the anterior part of her jaw. And so go in, you remove that part of the jaw with a margin, right? And so now you have this bone defect, right? And so you can't leave someone like that because the soft tissue, yeah, the face will just contract over it and give you something called an Andy Gump deformity. So I went down to her leg and I removed a portion of her fibula bone. So not the shin bone, but the one next to it. And I harvested that on an artery and a vein. And I brought that up and I made cuts in it to reshape it to the jaw. And I put a plate and put it onto the jaw and dropped the vessels down into the neck and sewed them together and then brought the skin back over it. And so she's got a new jaw. And so, you know, down the road, she can actually come in and get dental implants and they can put teeth there and we can try to make it as close as possible to like it never happened, right? And so these are complicated procedures. And there were some plastics guys here doing it before I got here. There were some other head and neck guys doing the removal of the tumor before I got here. But there wasn't a guy that was doing both sides that was able to remove the tumor and also able to do a free flap to reconstruct it. And there didn't seem to be anyone that was, at least with a high level of frequency, doing transoral robotic surgeries or especially salvaged laryngectomies, okay? Meaning someone has already had radiation for laryngeal cancer, cancer came back. So their only shot now is to remove it surgically. When you do that, after a patient has been radiated, it gets complicated because those people don't heal very well. And so you need a free flap for that. And, you know, that's kind of a big deal in the East Tennessee area because Tennessee carries the fifth highest smoking rate in the country. And so there are a lot of people here that have this problem. And their only option beforehand was to go to Vanderbilt, right? And go 2.5 hours away for all of those appointments. And so that was kind of one of the things that brought me here to do this thing. I've definitely, I think, jumped in the deep end, and there is a lot of need, and I feel like I've been able to help a lot of people, but that's kind of in summary what it is that I'm doing. The guy that you don't want to have to see, but if you need him, you need
him. You want him, yeah, no doubt. Awesome. I feel very well versed in an area I knew nothing about beforehand, at least I'm sure on a superficial level, but a lot more than what I knew before, and I know our listeners too. You know, we'll really value the information that you've, you know, provided here. So yeah, thank you so much. Is there anything, I think we, you know, got through most of the topics. Is there anything that we missed that would be helpful to bring up?
No, I don't think so. And very, very niche stuff. I hope I didn't bore anyone to sleep with that. But I would say that if you have a concern about head and neck cancer, just schedule an appointment and come in and get it looked at. To all the men out there that don't want to go to the doctors, and I'm one of you, Just schedule the appointment, come in and have it looked at. You'll never regret that decision.
Yeah, no doubt. Oh yeah, thank you so much. We love to wrap up the podcast with a few just questions, maybe a little bit more lighthearted questions.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Head and neck cancer.
Absolutely.
Especially with you being relatively new to Knoxville as well, right? How long have you been here in Knoxville?
Coming up on 2 years.
2 years, yeah. So this is, be interested to hear your answers to these questions. We've had other podcast guests that have been, you know, here a long time, others that have been relatively short, but to hear your kind of your impression of Knoxville through these questions. But love to hear if you tell us something maybe on your bucket list to do, and maybe that's extensive since you haven't been here too long, but something that you've been wanting to do around Knoxville, kind of East Tennessee area.
I want to get to a Tennessee baseball game.
Okay.
And that's apparently not super easy to do these days because they're playing really well and those tickets are not easy to come by. But I would say that's absolutely on my bucket.
Yeah, I'll say you can get to a midweek game, you know, when they're not playing SEC, you know, a little easier.
That's what I got
to
look at.
I've been to a few of those, one this past year, you know, granted they're maybe not quite as exciting, but still you can find those tickets. well, awesome. Well, what about a favorite place to enjoy around Knoxville outside? Now, you like to do a lot of outside stuff in your free time.
Well, we definitely like to go down and walk Cherokee Trail. But one place that we kind of came across recently, which I wouldn't necessarily count this as an outdoor activity, like quite the opposite from a health perspective, but Cruz Farms.
Okay.
Their ice cream is unbelievable.
On the farm, not Market Street or the one downtown.
The one that's kind of outside of Knoxville.
Yeah, we haven't been there.
I've not been to the one downtown, okay. But the one outside of Knoxville. And they have a little pizza place right next to it, but yeah. We go out there for the ice cream, and there's I have a little 2-year-old. And sure. So there's room for him to like run around yeah. And be crazy. And, they'll give him a little sample of the ice cream and he always makes a, you know, a huge mess of it. But that's what he's supposed to do. Right. So right. I would say that's something that we have really enjoyed doing, as of late, especially with it getting hot around here.
Well, the next question, and it kind of, I don't know if you have a different answer, but it's a favorite restaurant. you mentioned Cruise Farm, because that's not, you know, necessarily a restaurant, more experience, but yeah, where would you like to go out to eat if you're going out with your wife?
Yeah, I would say probably my favorite is J.C. Holdway. They have a really good menu, really good food. Not the sort of place that I go to all the time, sure. But if it's a special occasion, I remember after I passed my board exam for board certification, we went there. Yeah, so I would say that's. Yeah, I would say it's probably my favorite so far.
Best tip and recommendation for staying healthy, you know, and if, you know, applied to maybe head and neck kind of health in general.
Yeah. You guys listening probably can guess what I'm going to say, but, try to stop smoking. If you're smoking, try to stop smoking. And the best way to go about doing that is, people say, oh, I'm cutting back. The best way to go about doing it is you meet with your primary care physician, you tell them you want to quit, and you develop a plan. If you need nicotine patches, if you need Chantix, if you need Lozenges, whatever you got to do, go ahead and try to set that plan in motion, set a quit date, try to go ahead and get it done. And just know that most people have to try a couple of times before they're successful, and don't become discouraged by that, but it could literally add decades onto your life.
Sure. Awesome. Well, last question is how can people get in touch with you? What's just an easy way to connect?
Yeah, so I work out of the Greater Knoxville ENT Clinic. Their appointment line is 865-244-4396. And if you want to see me specifically, just say, hey, I'd like to see Dr. Dunlap. I will put a disclaimer out there. I do see general ENT patients, but I would say probably upwards of 90-95% of the operations I'm doing now are head and neck cancer. And so, especially if you think you have one of those problems, just ask to see me and I will get you in as soon as I possibly can.
Awesome. Yeah. And then, you can find, the website if you need to look for some more information. So what is, Greater Knoxville ENT, just Google that, right?
That's right. Yeah. You can Google Greater Knoxville ENT. I've only been here for 2 years, but that group has been around for a long time. We're a group of eight, I think coming up on nine, and, a lot of good ENTs in that group.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, for coming on the show. Really appreciate you sharing your wealth of knowledge here with, our community here in Knoxville, but I know we have listeners from all over as well. Really valuable information, Dr. Dunlap.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, no problem. Yeah, stay healthy, Knoxville.
Thank you for tuning in to the Stay Healthy Knoxville podcast, brought to you by Simply Physio. If your pain is preventing you from staying healthy and active, and you'd like to avoid surgery, pain medicine, or just want to get back to doing the things you love in and around Knoxville, we offer both a free ebook and free over-the-phone consultation to help you figure out the root cause of your pain and the next best steps for resolving it. Find our ebooks online at simplypt.com/health-tips. There you will find ebooks for topics such as neck and shoulder pain, lower back and hip pain, knee pain, and TMJ. These quick-to-read reports will provide you with expert tips, tricks, and exercises to help solve your pain from the comfort of your own home. Just visit simplypt.com/health-tips to download your ebook and have it delivered directly to your inbox. We also offer free, no-obligation phone consultations with a doctor of physical therapy to Knoxville area residents. Just call us at 865-351-0615 or visit us at simplypt.com and click the Talk to a PT button on the home page to schedule a call with us. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next time on the Stay Healthy Knoxville podcast.